Well, it's great to be back, and I particularly have been really enjoying this journey that we've been having through the Gospel of Mark, because it is, as I often say, so rich. It's so rich. And by that meaning, I mean that there is these layers of detail and insight and revelation that I believe that God has for every single one of us. And when we hear in Mark chapter 5, we actually have two daughter stories. Is the way it's framed. You've got one that is in a position of influence, that is the daughter of the leader of the synagogue, and then you have another daughter who was one on the absolute margins, and that was a woman who was not permitted in the synagogue, and that was the bleeding woman. Now, we skipped over that in our text today, but this passage is deliberately framed around these two daughters, the one who is the daughter of Jairus and the other one who Jesus declares, "Daughter, your faith has healed you." Because what the gospel writer is trying to do within this passage is to make it very clear that this is a message for everyone. Whether you are the daughter of the leader of the synagogue, the one in authority, or whether you are the daughter whom I declare to be the daughter, even though you have never been allowed to step foot in the synagogue. And I spoke on this other daughter, the bleeding woman, back in October 22. And we talked about Jesus walking through this crowd and her reaching out to touch the edges of his prayer shawl, the tzitzit, right? And there would be she would find healing in his wings, which is this word kanaf, okay? And I encourage you to go back and listen to that message if you're interested in that story. We just don't have time to deal with both daughter stories today. Instead, I want to focus on Jairus' daughter and what it has for us. So let's just go through our text once again. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue leaders, named Jairus, came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. He pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed around him. And then those next verses will be Jesus healing the bleeding woman. We're going to jump forward. While Jesus was still speaking, some people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Overhearing what they said, Jesus told him, "Don't be afraid, just believe." He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue leader, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha cum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." And immediately the girl stood up and began to walk around. She was 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat. You know, a couple of weeks ago, I was down in Victoria, and it was a big deal because apparently it is such a big deal that they need an additional public holiday for the AFL Grand Final. It's almost like they have to prepare themselves for the excitement a day early, and so they just take the day off. And whenever it comes to AFL Grand Finals or finals of any kind, it always makes me very, very nervous. And this isn't because I'm genuinely interested in the sport. It's because of the commentators. Because these expert commentators who do give detail about the game sometimes make the most outlandish statements. And the statement that I get the most nervous about is when they call it. And by that I mean they call the game for a particular team. Now, a couple of weeks ago when whatever two teams were playing, it was a pretty bad game, which means that they were calling it probably about halfway through the game, right? Because one team was several goals ahead, lots of goals ahead, had all that momentum. But even when they call it that far ahead, it makes me very, very nervous. Because part of me goes, who knows what might happen? You cannot say that this is the end. You are supposed to be the authority on the matter, and here you are telling me with two quarters to go that it is over. No, 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 no. I've seen Steve Bradbury, I've seen situations where things have been called, right, and they don't turn out the way that you expect. And so I find myself in that situation going, don't do it, don't call it, don't call it, because it isn't over yet, right? But some people are tempted to call it. They're saying, well, things are what they are. Things aren't changing. We need to call this what it is. And sometimes I would encourage you, even thinking locally around Alice Springs. Sometimes we look at the state of our town and we know that people go through traumatic experiences. And some people are experiencing dysfunctional workplaces. Some people here in Alice are experiencing isolation and loneliness, right? I mean, even just prior to me going, we had several young suicides, which is just absolutely tragic, right? And there is a temptation, right, when we see these patterns to just kind of fall into this mentality of, well, it is what it is. Or maybe we kind of ask this question, is this like how it ends? Is just this the normal now? Is this over? I mean, I just need to accept that this is what it is, right? We might even be so bold as to say a statement like, this is just how life is here in Alice. And so each of us have these experiences, whether it be a workplace, a relationship, or an internal feeling, or an addiction, where we're tempted to say, is this how it ends? And you might be here today, and you might be on the edge, a bit like Jairus was. He's got his daughter who is deeply, deeply sick, so unwell, right? That he comes and he begs for Jesus' attention. And the good news is that in these times of desperation, Jesus meets us in these places. That's what this story is about. Jesus meeting him in this place. Because this is a gospel. This is good news. So let's just have a look at our text here again, because you know I love this. Let's look at these couple of verses. One of the synagogue leaders named Jairus came. Now notice the fact that the gospel writer is not afraid to name drop, okay? Like, the gospel writer doesn't say, oh, synagogue, he names him Jairus, right? And so if people are reading this gospel, you know, only several potentially decades on, or these stories being circulated verbally over time, they can go check with Jairus, right? We know Jairus. We can check whether or not this happened. And so there's this authority to this gospel writer that he's communicating here. So he came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. He pleaded earnestly with him, my little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so she will be healed and live. I think this is, as a kind of a starting point, I think this is really helpful for us to understand, particularly as people who have a lot of power and influence. Now, some days you may not feel like you have power and influence, but I promise you we have power and influence. And as people who have power and influence, who have, you know, resources that can be leveraged, relationships that can be leveraged, for many people, we have a lot of physical capital. We've got energy that can be leveraged. There is always a temptation to do things in our own strength, right? Because that's what power deceives us into thinking. If we've got power, then we can do it alone. We can fix this. We can overcome this. Think about how many people have come to Alice and saying, well, don't worry, I've got the right answer. I can fix this one because I've got do, right? And this isn't just people from out there. This is us, right? This is us. We're tempted to do this too. And yet we can learn so much from Jairus' posture here. You can see his desperation, falling at Jesus' feet. He pleaded earnestly with him. There is this sincerity and this humility. Please come, Jesus. I know that I have influence as a leader in the synagogue, but actually I need you right now. And again, I know that I'm challenged not to exhaust all the other options before I come to Jesus, right? This is the challenge for me. What we see here is that Jairus begins with this kind of humble desperation. And it's a desperation that genuinely believes that Jesus can do something and that he has power. And who knows the implications of a synagogue leader coming to Jesus? There was kind of a bit of a mixed reception to some of Jesus' teachings at the time. And so Jairus was putting perhaps even some of his reputation on the line, and yet there was this humility and desperation that we see. And so I want to be the kind of person who imitates Jairus' posture. When there's an issue that needs addressing, when there is something that is overwhelming my heart and I'm tempted to say, is this just how it is? Do I firstly seek to exhaust all my options, all my creativity, all my resources, or do I first come to Jesus in humility and desperation? Because that's what Jairus did. We begin with humble desperation. Please come and put your hands on her. Let's continue. While Jesus was still speaking, some came from the house of Jairus. This is, again, just jumping over the bleeding woman. The synagogue leader, "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Overhearing what they said, Jesus told him, "Don't be afraid, just believe." A few things I just want to pick up on here, first of all. When the people came, they said, "Why bother the teacher anymore?" I know it's been a few weeks since I reiterated this, but I just want to reiterate it again. The understanding of Jesus' audience of the time was that he was a teacher, not a healer. He was a teacher. The healing gave authority to his teaching, right? So the healing backed up his teaching. So he would teach that the kingdom of God is at hand, repent and believe the good news, as in get on board with what God is doing, right? And then the healing validated that. The people he healed were going to die again, okay? It was a temporary sign. But this is an important detail that we need to keep on picking up as we go. They say, "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Overhearing what they said, Jesus told him, "Don't be afraid, just believe." I find Jesus' response to this situation quite fascinating. It's interesting that he doesn't say, "Don't believe them." Because later on in the story, he's going to declare that the daughter is not dead but asleep, which raises all sorts of questions, of course. You know, was she actually dead? Was she actually asleep? We'll talk about why he said that a little bit later on. But he doesn't say, "Don't believe them." He says, "Don't be afraid." And for us, it's important to understand that when Jesus says, "Just believe," particularly in the first century context, this isn't just intellectual affirmation. Just think differently. Just believe. Belief was connected with action. He's saying, "Do not be afraid, just continue to walk with me. The very thing that you did before, coming to me with humble desperation, you need to continue to do." Because belief isn't intellectual affirmation, it is action for Jesus in the first century. And so Jesus is saying to Jairus, "Keep on trusting me. I know that the news has reinforced perhaps that question you had at the beginning, is this over? Is this it? And yet, in this moment, I want you to not be afraid of what these other voices are saying. I want you to continue to trust me. Continue to allow me to walk with you into those circumstances that might otherwise simply intimidate you and cause you to call it for what it apparently is." And I love this because essentially I'm picking up on some of that language that those people came back. "Do not bother the teacher anymore." Jesus is like, no, please bother me. Bother me. Bother me about this. Continue to come to me about this. You may hear stories that reinforce your despair, but continue to bother me with this. Do not be afraid. Just believe. You see, it's one thing to let Jesus in like Jairus did at the beginning. It's another to walk with Jesus through the storms, through the setbacks, through the competing voices that we hear in our world. And you'll notice this refrain through this story, this pattern that continues to emerge, where there were many, many people who were ready to move on. They were ready to move on and just be like, "It is what it is. Stop bothering him." They'll laugh at Jesus. They'll say, no. That's not how things work. And yet Jesus invites us to continue to trust and bother him. And so whatever it is right now that feels overwhelming and feels perhaps inevitable, do you believe that Jesus isn't done with that thing yet? Let's talk about like local crime. Do you believe that Jesus isn't done with that situation yet? Like, do you believe that? Or have you said, let's not bother Jesus with this anymore? He's got other bigger fish to fry. He will fry fish later, but that's another story. Oh, I can't help but say it. The end of this, got to say this, is so good. The end of this, he's like, give her food, right? Just give her something to eat. What a weird way to end the story. Give her something to eat. Eating and redemption come up so regularly, right? Peter on the shores of the beach, having breakfast with Jesus. Anyway, just, I've got to put it out there. It's so good, right? Sometimes we can be so quick to move on that we miss the miraculous. And people might laugh and they say, there is no way that Jesus is resurrecting that situation. That workplace is so toxic. There is no way that Jesus is resurrecting that, right? And the truth is that we tend to give up before God does. We tend to give up before God does. He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue leader, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. You must imagine Jairus at this point. Do not be afraid, just believe. Do not be afraid, just believe. With every single step that he's taking closer to that house, as he starts to hear the commotion as he approaches that house, do not be afraid, just believe. He went in and said to them, why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep. And they laughed at him. Now, in Jewish culture of the day, when somebody dies, you had professional mourners come in. And they came in, and these mourners were actually there for a purpose. They were there to help guide you through that 1 week period of mourning and that 1 week period of grief. So that was their job. They came and they were there as professionals to help guide you through grief. And that's a good thing because, let's be honest, we don't do grief very well for the most part. And so that's why there was all this commotion. The daughter has died. And so there they are, very quickly, mind you, starting the process of grieving. And please don't hear me wrong in the midst of this broader conversation. There are certainly times to mourn and grieve, okay? I don't want this just to be of kind of like, hey, just never give up on anything or anything like that. That's not what this is about. Jesus himself wept, right, about the state of the world because evil and death does not belong. But Jesus comes to this house and those professional mourners are there and they're getting started doing their thing, right? And Jesus is like, no, this story is not over. Go away. This story isn't over. I know you're doing your thing and you're here for a purpose, but no, this story isn't over. Go away. And what do? They laugh at him. And who wouldn't? Who wouldn't laugh? No, Jesus, you don't understand. I know you're kind of a big shot right now, but seriously, this girl is dead. We are doing our thing. Just step back. And Jesus is like, it's not over. But they believe it's over. They believe it's over. This is just how it is. They've called it. And what's really fascinating about this is you got to ask the question, is Jesus wrong? The child is not dead, but asleep. I mean, surely it actually would have been more impressive if he was like, she is dead, but watch this. So which one's more impressive, right? She's not dead, but she's asleep. So I go in there and apparently wake her up. Or she is dead, but check this out, I'm going to go and resurrect her. So one of those is slightly more impressive. And yet Jesus makes this incredibly bizarre statement. She is not dead, but she is asleep. And essentially Jesus is saying through this statement, things are not as they appear. You've already decided that things are a certain way and you've made observations and you've connected patterns and you know when this happens and this happens, this happens, then the professional mourners kick into gear and we do our thing. But Jesus says, actually, things are not as they appear. The story isn't over. There is something more going on here. And we have to be reminded that Jesus is a teacher. And the gospel writer is communicating a far bigger story here. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him. and went in where the child was. And he took her by the hand and said to her, Talitha cum, which means, little girl, I say to you, get up. Immediately the girl stood up and began to walk around. She was 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished. Now, again, there is something bigger going on here than just a girl being brought back to life, which in and of itself would be amazing. But there are these echoes that we hear in this text, details that seem bizarre that they would be included. I mean, why is the gospel writer pointing out that she's 12 years old? It's not like when Jesus healed the blind man, it's like, oh, and he was 42 years old, right? This detail sticks out. Why the detail about him taking her by the hand? Why the detail about the language that he uses? For Mark, which is usually a gospel that is so rapid, it's like, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened. It's almost like the gospel writer slows down and gives just a bizarre amount of detail in terms of what is happening here. And that's because he is echoing or pointing out something that has been spoken before. Now, Megan actually introduced us to this concept a few weeks ago. She talked about remez, which means a hint or a clue. It was something that writers and rabbis did all the time, particularly when they knew that their audience understood the Old Testament or the Tanakh. They knew the scriptures. It was in them. That would be communicated to them through oral stories. And so they absorbed this text and they lived by it, especially in places like the Galilee. And so the gospel writers would place these hints or these clues that were designed to point us towards something that had previously been said to say, hey, what you are seeing here is connected to what happened back there. The remez is like a treasure map. And you hunt for the clues and you find the drash, which is the treasure. So as we note these details, taking her by the hand, this phrase, get up, this detail, she was 12 years old. And even this, she is not dead, but she is asleep. We have to go, what is going on here? I mean, Lazarus was dead. Jesus made that very clear. But she's not dead, she's asleep. She's 12 years old. Why is the number 12 significant in Jewish tradition? The 12 tribes of Israel. These words, get up, arise. And when we follow these clues, we see that it leads us to Isaiah. Isaiah 51 through to chapters Isaiah 53. Now you might go, well, that's a large chunk of text, Gavin, but this is the text that was embodied within people. This isn't just like referencing one text, it's referencing the story of these passages. Notice these words from Isaiah 51:17. Awake, awake, rise up. Hear the symbols in here? Jerusalem, you have drunk from the hand of the Lord the cup of his wrath. You who have drained to its dregs the goblet that makes people stagger. Among all the children she bore, there were none to guide her. Among all the children she reared, there was none to take her by the hand. So we're talking about Isaiah, this nation who was in captivity and oppressed, right? And they're asking the question, is it over? Is this all there is to our story? Isaiah 52, again, awake, awake, Zion, clothe yourself with strength, put on your garments of splendor, Jerusalem, the holy city. The uncircumcised and defiled will not enter you again. Shake off your dust, rise up, sit enthroned, Jerusalem, free yourself from the chains on your neck, daughter Zion, now a captive. And Isaiah 53, this is what those two chapters lead to. And I just wonder if you can make the connection here with what the gospel writer is trying to do here in Mark. Hey, how you doing? Who has believed our message and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain, like one from whom people hide their faces. He was despised, and we held him in low esteem. But surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering. Yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. Now, just to be very clear about the he's in this Isaiah 53 passage. And when you look at the story that is being articulated here, we see the way that Jesus himself embodied this prophetic statement. He took up our pain and bore our suffering. He was pierced for our transgressions. By his wounds we are healed. And so the gospel writer, by talking about how Jesus engaged this daughter who was not dead but asleep, things are not what as they appear. The story is not over. He echoes back to Isaiah and the prophets saying, we are here, we're under oppression, is our story over? And God is saying, just as Jesus was saying about the daughter, no. It's not dead, just asleep. Because resurrection is coming. Arise, arise. This statement, among all the children, verse 18, there was none to guide her. And so these echoes of what Jesus is doing with this daughter who is not dead but asleep, he's speaking to these prophetic voices that said, well, you have been here before. You have thought it was all over before. And guess what? You had none to guide you. But guess what? There's good news. For there is one who is guiding you right now. And we know who he is. The story isn't over. The story isn't over. I wonder what kind of grief, what kind of assumptions you are carrying with you right now. These areas where you feel like you just called it, that relationship is over, that pattern of behavior is not changing, that opportunity will never emerge. And while we might be tempted to say, hey, don't bother the teacher anymore, while we might be tempted to start the grieving process, and again, disclaimer, I'm not saying there isn't time to grieve, but we often give up on things before God does. I wonder where Jesus needs to declare, hey, that thing in your life, it isn't dead. It's just asleep. That thing that keeps you up at night, the child that's drifted away from faith and I've just kind of given up and been like, no, well, that just is what it is. It's not dead, just asleep. It may seem like all that can be done at some points is to mourn, but Jesus says, don't be afraid, just believe. Keep trusting me. Keep walking with me to that house because the story isn't over. Your daughter isn't dead. She's asleep. What is asleep in your life? What is asleep in your life? Because after Jairus came to Jesus in humble desperation, he would walk with him to that house, and Jesus would take that daughter's hand and speak words of power, and she would arise. And what would be their response be? They would be astonished. They'd be astonished. Like, what? It says, immediately the girl stood up and began to walk. She was 12 years old, and at this they were completely astonished. The Greek word there is ecstasis. And he gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this. It is no mistake that this same word, ecstasis, appears at the end of Mark's gospel, his original ending of the gospel. In Mark 16, verse 8, following another resurrection of Jesus himself, it says, trembling and bewildered, ecstasis, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. Jesus would use this same word to conclude his gospel because resurrection, Jesus' resurrection, and the kind of resurrection that God wants to do in all of our lives is real, and the story isn't over. The story isn't over. So let's just take a moment now. I'm just going to take a minute of quiet as best we can. And I want to invite each of us to consider, is there something that you have declared dead that God wants to remind you is asleep? And it doesn't mean that it doesn't hurt. And it doesn't mean that it's not going to require humble desperation. But actually, the daughter isn't dead. She's asleep. Let's take that moment now. Jesus, we thank you for the good news that the story isn't over. That's what you declare. Whether it be work environments, broken relationships, kids who have drifted, addiction, trauma that feels like it will forever affect us. God, help us to come to you in humble desperation. Help us to continue to trust your voice over the other competing voices in our world. May we enter into those rooms with just a few and allow you to speak words of power. Because God, you are faithful. You have brought nations from this edge. You have brought people from this edge. And Lord, you will faithfully meet us in these edges where we say, is this all there is? May we heed your words of authority as you declare the story isn't over. Amen.